As we begin the class, I'd like to read the first question and answer from the Heidelberg Catechism. Question is, what is your only comfort in life and in death? That I'm not my own, but belong body and soul, in life and in death, to my faithful Savior, Jesus Christ. He has fully paid for all my sins with his precious blood and has set me free from the tyranny of the devil. He also watches over me in such a way that not a hair can fall from my head without the will of my Father in heaven. In fact, all things must work together for my salvation. Because I belong to him, Christ, by his Holy Spirit, assures me of eternal life and makes me wholeheartedly willing and ready from now on to live for him. Lord, we thank you for the great comfort that the gospel brings to us, the gospel of life and salvation. And we pray that we may live in the light of this truth, that we may have the same respect for physical life that you do, and that we may have the same motivation to spread your gospel that motivated the reformers who wrote this wonderful catechism. Be with us in our generation, we pray, to uphold your word, we ask for Jesus' sake. Amen. Now, the issue that we have left under respect for human life, this is a point E, the fifth point, is human embryo research. This was in the news last week as the Senate had held hearings on federal funding for human embryo stem cell research. And I'll explain a little bit about what that means. The current law, in the handout that I gave you last time, on the reverse side of significant events in a new life, is the current law on federal funding of human embryo research. And so you can read that there. None of the funds made available in this act may be used for the creation of a human embryo or embryos for research purposes. And research in which a human embryo or embryos are destroyed, discarded, or knowingly subject to risk or injury or death greater than that allowed for research on fetuses in utero is forbidden. And notice how they define human embryo or embryos, any organism, not protected as a human subject and so forth, that is derived by fertilization, parthenogenesis, cloning, or any other means from one or more human gametes, that's the sperm and egg, or human diploid cells, that's the union of the sperm and egg cell. Now, on the last page of this, the handout, is on stem cell research into human embryo, a Christian analysis. Under point two, how were scientists able to obtain these cells? They give two means by which they were obtained. The Wisconsin team obtained its cells from surplus embryos donated by fertility clinics. We have frozen embryos accumulating at the rate of 10,000 a year that are not wanted by those who conceive them. And so the last time I checked, it's been 3 or 4 years. We have 50,000 of these that are simply being maintained in frozen form. And so these were donated by the clinics and for research. The other research team at Johns Hopkins derived their stem cells from aborted fetal tissue. There is now a third means by which human stem cells are derived that you might want to just add append a note there. Michael West, who is the head of a company called Advanced Cell Research, has cloned human embryos, removing the genetic material from cow's eggs and inserting human cell tissue. And so that's the third area that is from which these stem cells are derived. A human embryo has now been created by cloning. That's just last month in Great Britain, there was a recommendation from the agency that is responsible for ethics in these things to allow cloning as a source of embryos for stem cell research in Britain. So this is where the current issue is, And there are all sorts of advantages that come from stem cells that have great potential. Very moving testimony, very emotional testimony by Christopher Reed, the idea that you can replace a spinal cord as well as treat Parkinson's disease and a number of these things shows the great potential good that could be done from embryo stem cell research. Now, in the way in which this is reported, typically you get a dismissive phrase that this is all affected by abortion politics. And if we didn't have abortion politics, then there wouldn't be any question about this research going forward. Well, I say, thank God for abortion politics. Let me explain what I mean by that. There are at least some people who are holding the line, trying to hold the line in terms of federal funding that would further institutionalize abortion in this country. It's been going on for some years, since the 70s, since Roe v. Wade. There has been the one area where pro-life movement has been able to hold the line is on federal funding of abortion or federal funding of research that involves abortion. The idea is that Roe v. Wade established the right of a woman to choose abortion, but that's different from approval of abortion, which would be, if we get into federal funding, that goes beyond tolerance to sanction. And beginning in the 70s, there was a strong movement to resist, even with the abortion on demand, taking that as at face value as the right to choose abortion. The right to choose abortion doesn't mean that the state may not express its non-complicity in abortion by refusing federal funding. It's just the one edge of hole, the one fingernail hole that has been in effect for the last year. It begins with fetal tissue research. There's a distinction between fetal tissue research and live fetal research. Research on human beings in the womb from implantation to birth has been denied federal funding since 1975. Even if that fetus is going to be aborted, you cannot experiment on that. So federal funding of live fetal research is permitted only if the experiment is therapeutic for that particular child. The experimental surgery of spina bifida and so forth, that is therapeutic for that particular child, or is somehow necessary for gathering information, poses no risk to the child. Now, that's still on the books, that you may not experiment on a fetus in the womb, even though it's scheduled for abortion. Even though a woman has a legal right to choose abortion, the living fetus is still treated as a subject with human dignity. That's the value of having that that law denying federal funding. Of course, in private clinics that are not federal funding, that may be gone. But at least it doesn't have public support through taxation. And fetal tissue research, on the other hand, involves the use of tissue following the death of a fetus. And those have been going on in the early part of the century without much success. But use of such tissue from spontaneous abortions or miscarriage or from indirect abortion are not the issue. The issue is whether we should allow such research in terms of federal funding of tissue research using induced abortion. Fetuses from induced abortion. Now, there's an interesting development here I want just to share with you. In 1988, the Bush administration banned the federal funding of fetal tissue research using aborted fetuses for transplant. That was by an administrative order. That ban was rescinded by President Clinton January 22, 1993. That was his first act on assuming office. It was in your face to the pro-life movement because they were gathered there on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade to protest abortion, and he did that. Now, by administrative fiat, he removed that ban. Now, what gets glossed over is that later in that year. It was actually June 10, 1993, that the president signed into a law, a bill passed by Congress that permitted fetal tissue research on aborted fetuses. It would pass overwhelmingly. It's the National Institutes of Health Reauthorization Act. The Senate 96-4, the House of Representatives 283-13. It's not just President Clinton. Okay, there's strong congressional support of this, and as one person who is was sympathetic to this move has said, the irresistible pull of progress in the end trumps moral concerns. I fear that's true. I fear that's true, but we should recognize there was overwhelming support of that in Congress. And the argument shifted this way. Of course, we may not do evil that good may come, but the argument was, can't we at least bring good out of evil? Granted that abortion is evil, can't we at least do some good with this fetal tissue that otherwise would be incinerated? And the act included a number of safeguards that help gain congressional support. Doctors performing the abortion must certify that the women specifically consented to the abortion before being asked to donate fetal tissue. Okay. The decision has to be made, and then you ask. And also banned departures from standard abortion procedures. She had to certify that she doesn't know who the recipient is. And so there were these safeguards, including it made it a felony to purchase or sell the tissue for profit. But it did allow reasonable charges to be paid to companies that extract and transfer the tissue to researchers. Now, a pro-life activist at the time said, I'll quote one, "How long before we have an unregulated fetus industry in which the organs of unborn babies are bought and sold as commonly as pints of blood?" And the answer to that is about 5 years. This was the story that broke last fall. It was a good report in World Magazine in October last year of the sale of fetal tissue for transplant. Fetal body parts with price tags attached, brain, foot, whatever you want. It's a grotesque industry and was featured on one of the evening news programs, and congressional hearings were held. But as so often happens, the pro-research forces attacked the witness. They attacked the whistleblower and attacked his motivation, and nothing came of it. You know, there's all this big noise that body parts from aborted babies are being sold for profit, and that's a felony. But no one is really interested in pursuing that to go to the trouble of finding out how it's done. But, you know, there is a symbiotic relationship between researchers and abortion clinics, in which it's to the advantage of abortion clinics to have these folks on site where they can have access to the body parts. And it's clear that there is the law is being circumvented. It's just one of those areas where all parties claim no one is buying or selling fetal tissue. One of those areas where people were shocked, even those who had supported the idea of abortion were shocked by buying and selling fetal tissue. A spokesperson from Planned Parenthood said it was inappropriate. That's not a strong moral critique. But the subject was changed in the House hearings, and so a moral dilemma is obscured. There's a very great hardness of heart on this issue, so that any question of that, what it would take to enforce the law shows how we ought not to so easily be distracted by safeguards. We have to ask, are the safeguards enforceable? Is there the will to enforce the safeguards? And it was predicted at the time by astute pro-life activists that it would be not likely. Now, the progress overcame the scruples. The embryonic stem cell research is at the same place in the debate. I think that it's very courageous for people to oppose this on principle grounds, but it is a living human embryo. Those who argue the other side, I won't take time to go into the details of stem cell research. You've got the two-page analysis there. But those are on the other side. Michael West of Advanced Cell Technology, for example, is quoted in Nature Medicine, asked the question this way. Does a blastocyst, that's the union, that's the one-cell embryo that begins developing, the zygote that develops to a blastocyst over a few days, does a blastocyst warrant the same right and reverence as that accorded a living soul, a parent, a child, or a partner who might die, because we failed to move the moral line? I think that my response to that would be, we don't draw the moral line. You know, if we move the moral line, it can be moved anywhere. Indeed, as Arthur Kaplan, University of Pennsylvania, said before the committee, we don't live in a world of moral absolutes. Well, what that means is, if there are no moral absolutes, then nothing is forbidden. We used to sing, if God is dead, everything is permitted. Well, you can state it the other way, too. If we don't live in a world of moral absolutes, then nothing is forbidden. Is the moral line something that is under our control, or is the moral line something that we discover? The other question is, there's a great resistance to the idea that a embryo is a living human being. It begs the question, if you put it in terms of that term, does a blastocyst have the same rights as a person whose life we might save? Then of course you feel the pull of that argument. The question is, what is the status of the blastocyst? Is that a living human being? And if you watched the news, you saw that exchange between Senator, forget his name, from Pennsylvania. Yeah, Spector, Arlen Spector, and the opponent of stem cell research, who raised the issue of experimentation on human beings in Nazi Germany. And Senator Spector said, but those were living human beings. And the answer came right back. This is a living human embryo. This is a living human being. I think that there's a line from Paul Ramsey. You might want to take this down, not to be tested on, but because I think that it's so much to the point. This goes back several years when cloning first was on the horizon as a theoretical possibility. He said this: the good things that men do, can be made complete only by the things they refuse to do. I think that's a great line. The good things that men do can be made complete only by the things they refuse to do. There are some moral lines. Not for us to move the moral line in terms of the good consequences that we can get out of them. You know, consequentialism is a principle for tyrants. And it's tyrants over embryos and fetuses as well as born human beings. If you draw the line, then nothing is forbidden. The good things that men do can be made complete only by the things they refuse to do. So is it abortion politics? Well, I don't dismiss that. It's trying to hold on to the dignity of the human being from its beginning. The life of every human being begins at conception. Now, there are alternatives to embryo stem cell research that have the same results. In Nature magazine in February, there's a feature article on stem cell research with both the ethical issues and the scientific issues drawn up. Adult, there's more possibility, or as much possibility, from using adult stem cells as there are from embryonic stem cells. And in the case of a particular adult, there's no rejection possible in terms of cells from his or her own body. So we really need to not think that we're shut in to all these horrors and nobody will be able to help. It's moving the research in other directions, putting federal funding into adult stem cell research. I think it's a significant issue. It's you might say that, well, if with open abortion, with abortion on demand, how can we... we allow abortion on demand. Is there any point in trying to hold on to the dignity of the embryo and not to using human embryos for research purposes? Well, I think that there is. I think that there's a great deal of interest in that. Yes. Well, I think that I have a problem with it. I think that it's forbidden knowledge. And I think that it ought not to have been gained, it ought not to be used. I feel the pull in the other direction, and I'm not suffering from Parkinson's disease, but I think that those who have it and refuse to involve themselves in aborted fetal tissue, or now it would be stem cells, are that. The embryonic stem cells are from a 5 to 7 day embryo. That's your blastocyst stage, normally before implantation in a natural childbirth. There is also primordial germ cells that are taken from a 6-week embryo. So experimentation is going on up to 6 weeks. The germ cells are the sperm and egg. And it's research on human beings without their consent. Yes. Especially disturbing is the consequentialist ethic that the end justifies the means. And so all of this progress, all of this good that can be done, overcomes any scruples, and you feel the pull of that, don't you? I mean, that's so much good. But if God has forbidden it, then there are other ways that to approach doing good in these same areas. We ought not to make it dependent upon this research. How murky it becomes in future times, because of it's hard to separate out in the future what has come from where. So we may face some hard questions later on. Yes, sir. Yeah, it is troubling. I'm not sure what to do with it. Once it's there, I think that once it's there and is common knowledge, the source of it was evil. But it knowledge is knowledge, and I'm not sure what to think about that. So it's a good question. I think to resist participating in it while it's still in its experimental stage, to encourage it to encourage it being done. At some point, the question may become moot, as how can you separate out what went into research? That may be impossible to do, and so I don't really have a firm position on that. I think that we're talking about federal funding. This is going on in private companies. And why should we bother to hold the line? The argument is this would be controlled if it's under federal funding. Well, that's private companies are going to go on to develop what they will for profit motives anyway. So I don't know that making the federal government a competitor is going to have that kind of control. And it really involves in my judgment, it involves the society in complicity with what is morally repugnant. I don't think that folks who believe that the life of every human being begins at conception and should be treated with dignity and respect from that event should be forced to support, to further entrench that as a social issue. I wanted to say something about that, because that's the cutting edge of where nascent human life is now. My topic was respect for nascent human life. That's the rationale for keeping abreast of where we're going as a society with experimentation on human beings for now at the embryonic stage. If we can move the line, then we can move the line further along. You know, is the line ours to move? And what is the status of that living being in the womb, or now in vitro? We need to move on to what is the sixth major heading, which I'm going to call Respect for the Natural End of Human Life. Respect for the natural end of human life. And I'm underscoring natural there. On the basis of biblical passages such as Psalm 90, verse 10, days of his years are 70, if they be 80 years, it's with sorrow, and so forth. Not many people at present live past 100. Now there's another area of research developing that promises open-ended aging. We need to look at that too. Keep up with the bioethics website that I shared with you, that address for these developments. There is an article already on analyzing that aspect of this. Ecclesiastes 3:2 is another one of those texts. In a fallen world, there's a time to be born and a time to die. And I think that we may paraphrase that. There's a time to resist death, and there's a time to cease resisting. You know, and what is that time is a matter for discernment. So it's respect for the natural end of human life, knowing when to resist death and knowing when it's time to cease resisting. PCA report, I won't go into them here, lists five biblical principles. It's the Heroic Measures report. I just want to list them. Don't try to take these down. They're in the handout so that you can get them. The first is God is sovereign over human life. You would expect us to begin there as Presbyterians, but it's an important point. Interact with it. Second, physical death is a relative evil. You know, and it's spiritual death that's the absolute evil. Physical death is a relative evil. We may give up our lives for the sake of the gospel, for example. Third, life is to be lived to its full extent to the glory of God. We use Philippians there, where Paul, even in the passage where it says, to depart and be with Christ is far better, yet lives on full to the full in terms of his calling before God. Number four, life is not to be abandoned on account of suffering. Our text there is Jesus' word to Peter at the end of the Gospel of John. You know, Peter wants to know, what about John? And Jesus says to him, follow me. When you're old, Jesus says to Peter, somebody else will dress you and take you where you don't want to go. And you follow me. And he was talking about the kind of death Peter would die. Now, what people fear is not so much pain as loss of control. That comes out again and again in these studies. Pain, we know, can be controlled. People do not fear pain so much as they fear being dependent on somebody else. Nobody wants other people to change their diapers at the end of life. You know, that's what people don't like. So to have that loss of autonomy, to be dependent, I don't want to be dependent on especially in this country, we have that strong independence that works against us. Well, that's, we don't want to suffer in being a burden on anybody. And Jesus says, follow me. He determines how we may glorify God through our death. And being recipients of the service of others, as well as the willing giving of it in terms of our ministry here, is part of God's plan, part of God's purpose in a fallen world. Then the fifth point is imminent death is to be met with realism and readiness. And we use the patriarchs there. They're ages from us, from technology. But the recognition that death is near and with final ministry to family and so forth is appropriate. Francis Schaeffer is our model there. In the last stages of Schaeffer's life, he made that tour to promote the film How Shall We Then Live? And the Mayo Clinic said to Edith, we're not going to, he's going to have to come in and have more radical stuff and in the hospital. And Schaeffer said, let me go home. It's time for me to die. Don't intervene. And so he forwent the equipment that would have maintained him for a few more days in order to be at home in the circle of his family and friends, ministering and being ministered to. That is a legitimate decision biblically. Do not intervene. It's time for me to die and to recognize when that time comes that life is not just mere length of days that we must extend as long as we possibly can using whatever technology and means is available. Imminent death is to be met with realism and readiness. Now, we need a definition of euthanasia. I have a number of preliminary things before... that you can get those biblical principles from the PCA report. But I'm using a definition of euthanasia that was put out by the U.S. Roman Catholic bishops in 1996. Take this down, please. Euthanasia, an action or omission. An action or omission which of itself or by intention causes death in order to relieve suffering. I'll run it by again. An action or omission which of itself or by intention causes death in order to relieve suffering. Euthanasia comes from the Greek. Good death, it means. It means easy death. Relatively painless death. It's mercy killing is what it really means, but the bishops are including in their definition an act of omission as morally culpable. So it's not simply mercy killing, but it's neglect, supposedly out of mercy, that would also fall under that definition. An action or omission which of itself or by intention causes death in order to relieve suffering. So that's the that's at least is the ostensible reason. Now, I think that we need to remember the larger catechism, questions 135 and 136 on the sixth commandment. Larger catechism treats it in terms of sins of commission and sins of omission. Sixth commandment is violated by sins of commission. You've heard these before. All taking away the life of ourselves or of others, except in the case of public justice, rigorously controlled capital punishment, lawful war, just in both cause and conduct, as we expanded on that, or necessary defense, that is, imminent threat to innocent life. All taking the way of our life, of ourselves, of others, except under those limited conditions. And sins of omission, which they define as neglecting or withdrawing the lawful and necessary means of preservation of life. very carefully crafted phrase and highly relevant to this moment in our thinking through of ethical issues, neglecting or withdrawing the lawful and necessary means of preservation of life. It's a good phrase. All taking away, that's the sin of commission, but also neglecting or withdrawing the lawful and necessary means of preservation of life, that is the sin of omission. Now, when we come to terminal decision making, that is, when death is imminent, I think we should distinguish three categories of decision. I think we should distinguish between killing and neglect. Both of those are morally wrong. Sin of commission, killing, the sin of omission, as the larger catechism defines it, neglect. I think that there is a third category of non-intervention in the dying process that ought not to be confused with neglect, which is morally culpable omission. Okay? We need three categories of distinction between killing, an act of commission, neglect, which is a sin of omission, and a morally right decision not to intervene in the dying process. Putting to death is killing. The phrase allowing to die is not specific enough to make this distinction. Allowing to die could mean culpable neglect, but allowing to die could mean non-intervention in the dying process as futile. I'll talk about the criteria for non-intervention later, but it's a great advantage to the proponents of euthanasia to blur these distinctions and to talk about killing as active euthanasia and to bracket these as passive euthanasia. And so so that non-intervention, morally just, morally appropriate non-intervention gets blurred in with culpable neglect. And the argument goes, since you approve non-intervention, passive euthanasia, why don't you approve active euthanasia? You know, there's a very great rhetorical issue involved in how these terms are used. So be on guard and try to sort that out. I think we need three categories, and the term passive euthanasia tends to blur that distinction and to create, by applying it to non-intervention, to create a favorable attitude toward euthanasia. Well, that's my concern anyway. Take it and see what you do with it. I'm going to treat this under three major headings. And the first heading is neonatal neglect. Neonatal neglect. This refers to newborns. The neglect of handicapped newborns is what this is talking about. And there is a case on record that I think is worth remembering, worth recalling, the case of Baby Doe. This was a case that goes back to 1982, Bloomington, Indiana. Child born with Down syndrome and a deformed esophagus, was allowed to die of starvation and dehydration, was allowed to die of neglect. The esophagus could have been corrected by routine surgery. Had it not been for the Down syndrome, it would have been corrected. But the parents decided against treatment. They did not want a retarded child. And so Baby Doe was allowed to die only because she was a Down syndrome baby. Now, what turned out at that time, that this is not that uncommon. We're not talking about babies that are born dying, in which heroic measures are futile. An anencephalic baby, a baby that's born without a brain, is going to die after a few days. A baby with only a brain stem is not going to live. And so you make that child comfortable. There were those who, we had a case in Florida, baby Teresa, in which folks wanted her to be killed in order to provide organs for transplant. She's going to die anyway. So why not salvage these organs? If we wait for her to die, they'll deteriorate and it won't be available for transplant. And the consequentialist ethic was used. In that case, Florida held the line and would not allow her to be killed for body parts. But we're talking about lives that can be saved and would be saved were there no handicap. Down syndrome, spina bifida. But we learned at the time that it's common in the United States to withhold routine surgery and medical care from infants with Down syndrome for the explicit purpose of hastening death. That's a form of omission that is euthanasia by omission. And it turned out that this was more common than we really noted. There was even a quality of life formula that was applied to infants to whether to decide to treat them or not. If they, based on the idea of little or no hope for achieving meaningful humanhood, and Down syndrome is the classic case, although, you know, there's a very... It's clear that Down syndrome babies grow up to be adults with a great interaction, a blessing to their families, that those who have had them. Now, in the coverage it was a program of neonatal neglect at Yale, management option, they called it. In the coverage of the Yale management option, the Yale Medical School management option, Newsweek used the term vegetables in describing certain handicapped newborns who were allowed to die. They're just vegetables. I mean, that wasn't their intention, but that's how they characterize them. Well, this produced a response from Sandra Diamond. I'll just read you her response. I'll wager my entire root system and as much fertilizer as it would take to fill Yale University that you have never received a letter from a vegetable before this one. But as much as I resent the term, I must confess that I fit the description of a vegetable as defined in the article. Due to severe brain damage incurred at birth, I am unable to dress myself, toilet myself, or write. My secretary is typing this letter. Many thousands of dollars had to be spent on my rehabilitation and education in order for me to reach my present professional status as a counseling psychologist. My parents were also told 35 years ago that there was little or no hope of achieving meaningful humanhood for their daughter. She was afflicted with cerebral palsy. Have I reached humanhood? Compared with Drs. Duff and Campbell, I believe I have surpassed it. Instead of changing the laws to make it legal to weed out us vegetables, let us change the laws so that we may receive quality medical care, education, and freedom to live as full and productive lives as our potentials allow. Now, that's a great letter. And you admire her spirit. And to put our investment as a society, to put our money in there. Money is a factor in these things, especially with Down syndrome. In 1995, the American College of OBGYN recommended Down syndrome screening for all pregnant women. Now, there's no cure for Down syndrome. Maybe they will get a genetic, maybe they'll find the gene like they've done. The first breakthrough just occurred this week for genetic screening. in terms of the immune deficiency. They finally found that, and two kids have been set free from the bubble. But that's the only one so far. And what it means usually is a death sentence for the Down syndrome fetus. Now, amniocentesis is $1,000. Down syndrome baby in the first year of life is $100,000. Well, now you can see how HMOs regard this. No, we've got a problem. We're going to have to think about, you know, what we do with health care. Well, following the publicity of the Baby Doe case, President Reagan ordered the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services to apply Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 to handicapped infants. The act prohibits discrimination against a handicap under any program receiving federal aid. Well, that got contested in the courts. Second Circuit Court decided against the administration, and a judgment not to perform certain surgeries. I'm quoting from the dissent. A judgment not to perform certain surgery because a person is black is not a bona fide medical judgment. So, too, a decision not to correct a life-threatening digestive problem because an infant has Down syndrome is not a bona fide medical judgment. So Congress then amended the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act to make explicit that withholding of medically indicated treatment from disabled infants with life-threatening conditions is included in the definition of child abuse and neglect. This is the way to get it. You know, there's all this uproar about child abuse, which I think, you know, I'm not depreciating that, but this is a form of child abuse. This is a form of child abuse. Now, I really bring this out because of the opposition that move received from Peter Singer, now at Princeton University. He opposed bringing newborns under the handicap, under the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act. He wrote this at the time: society cannot coherently hold that it is all right to kill a fetus a week before birth, but as soon as the baby is born, everything must be done to keep it alive. Well, that's true. That is incoherent. That is incoherent. Although we don't exactly say it's all right to kill a fetus, we say that a woman may make that choice. But I think, you know, practically we are saying it's all right. So Singer's solution, since we cannot coherently hold that it's all right to kill a fetus a week before birth, as soon as the baby born, do everything to keep it alive, the solution is to abandon the idea that all human life is of equal worth. The reasoning behind that is that the equal worth of human life is sectarian. That's a Christian conviction that you're imposing upon the society at large. You see how the thing moves? You know, separation of church and state. I mean, you get all the big guns in on an issue like this and claim that it's a sectarian view. Well, that view has been influenced by Christianity. The question is whether it's right. But it is true that the equal worth of human beings is Judeo-Christian tradition. But the question is whether, not whether it's sectarian, but whether it's true, whether that is the way human lives ought to be taught. I use this neonatal neglect issue because of Singer now going beyond what he said then. At the time, it was to allow them to die, but actually, wouldn't it be more merciful to kill them? Painlessly kill them, but, you know, to let them just starve to death, that doesn't seem to be merciful. Wouldn't it be more merciful just to kill them? Well, you know, if you agree that they can be neglected to death, then if you know, how much difference is there between an act of a sin of omission and a sin of commission? You know, it's the same murderous assault on innocent human life. But I would hope that we would rethink neglect, you know, and that we would rethink abortion. What is the difference 1 week before birth and a week after birth? You know, the infant is breathing on his own, but is that the key significant event when the baby takes air into its lungs? Oxygen has been doing all that other stuff via the blood of the mother. What is it that makes the difference there? But in terms of the way in which it, as I've mentioned before, in terms of the way in which the human being is not regarded as a person in the womb, it's the same after birth as before. If we define human beings in terms of functioning personhood, rather than we lose protection for innocent infant life as well as life in the womb. Yes, Jose. But you get your own show, Touched by an Angel. I don't watch it, but you know, Touched by an Angel has an evangelical Christian involved. And she's the writer and the producer, and that show doesn't appeal to me. I don't know why, but it's there as an alternative thing, and it has had some programs. You know, we create an alternative culture. We shouldn't just it's a world and life thing. We need folks in every sphere of culture doing the right thing. You know, you got my threefold model for social transformation, and it's personal renewal, ecclesial example, also structural reform. I'm talking about not just political reform, but cultural reform. We need folks doing their thing. Yes, sir. The most controversial question in that area is, giving food is assisted nutrition and hydration a medical intervention? And I've given you, for factual information, may have to delay this till next time, but for factual information, do dying patients really need IV fluids? It's written by a nurse who has the technical information, what actually goes on in the dying process that we need. But I'm sympathetic to your question, because when I served on the Heroic Measures Committee of the PCA, I went in with a different view, but there were ruling elders on that committee who were medical doctors, and they had the facts. And sometimes it's counterproductive to try to feed a dying person. The body shuts down and it can't metabolize, and you're hurting them by trying to force feed them. And the same is true with hydration. So that, and there's a reason to turn off machines, and that's why I say we need three categories of decision making, and non-intervention is the third. So we're coming to that. I feel your concern, because I've been through, that's probably the most in this area, the thing that I've been most asked in terms of pastoral question. People in our circles are not contemplating assisted suicide. I think that's a social issue. But they do want to know whether it's a sin of omission, whether the larger catechism's withholding the necessary means of the preservation of life means turning off that respirator. I mean, isn't air necessary? I mean, isn't oxygen necessary? No, that's a good question. My second main heading is physician-assisted suicide. The article that I have given to you for a handout from the Hastings Center report of last summer. Promoting autonomy or medicalizing suicide, I think, is a very good analysis of a cultural trend that affects this question. Let me just highlight a couple of things, and then you can work through this. On the second page, which is page 31 in terms of the article, and down at the bottom of that middle column, they say, incontestably, from a certain perspective, physician-assisted suicide is a dramatic expression of autonomy, empowerment, self-determination, and the like. The contemporary debate about death and dying has shifted focus from medical norms to individual rights, choices, and desires, a shift from outer codes to inner individuals. Okay? Then at the last paragraph in that column, the right-hand column, yet there's a paradox underlying physician-assisted suicide. It's conceived of as an intimate, existential act, indeed a response to modern medicine, but at the same time, it is a request for the complicity of physicians and society. This is not just an individual choice. This is asking for complicity of the medical profession and society, so that in contemporary Western society, the decision to take death in one's own hands has been construed as an act that is not simply personal, private, and solitary, but contrary to social norms and expectations. From a societal perspective, the individual who commits or attempts suicide is, in this sense, an outsider. What seems unusual in the debate about aid in dying is the request for public endorsement and legitimization of the act of suicide. That's what is the cultural trend for autonomy has overridden the right of society, or has overridden social norms. So we're in a total individualistic frame of mind. Whose life is it anyway? Well, it's my life. Well, that society has an interest in the life of all of its citizens. And you can read through the rest of that in terms of that. So I think that, first of all, what we think about suicide is the key issue. Now, the civil law does not make suicide a crime in this country. And that's also true in Great Britain. The Suicide Act of 1961 in Britain, you can do this all at once. Here it goes state by state. 61 decriminalized suicide, but at the same time it made aiding or abetting the suicide of another a crime punishable by up to 14 years. Let me just give you some figures on where we are in terms of the states and assisted suicide. By the way, to decriminalize suicide was not approval of suicide. It was only recognition that it only penalizes the family. And because most suicides are associated with depression, it's a criminal approach to what's a medical and psychological problem. So it was not appropriate area of the civil law to try to criminalize it. But assisted suicide, 35 states explicitly criminalize assisted suicide. The latest of those is Michigan, trying to get Dr. Kevorkian. In 1999, they finally passed the assisted suicide law. 9 states criminalize it through common law, not an explicit statute, but common law, so 35 plus 9. Then there, in the rest of the states, there's only one that explicitly permits physician-assisted suicide. That's Oregon since 1997. So you've got ambiguity in about 5 states, one state with explicitly permission. And if you follow the Oregon reports, it's distressing. The safeguards just don't work. What you get is doctor shopping. This is reported in, it comes out of Oregon. A woman, really her daughter, took her mother to get permission for physician-assisted suicide. But they went first to a psychiatrist, and he wouldn't give permission. He thought that it wasn't so clear to him that that's really what her mother wanted. And so she shopped for another doctor. And went this time to a psychologist. And after he didn't at first feel that that was that it warranted assisted suicide either, but it ended up someone in his office made the final decision. And I've got that article. Just give me a second here. I'll give you the reference for the where I got that. This is from the Weekly Standard, November 8th of last year. Final decision was left to an ethicist administrator. And he interviewed Cheney, who told him she wanted the pills not because she was in irremediable pain, but because she feared not being able to attend to her personal hygiene. And he gave the okay for assisted killing. You know, this puts, once you have this in the law, you create a permission for it. You even create an expectation for it. In a culture where people don't want to be a burden on somebody else, here's a law. It's safe and legal. You know, we shouldn't think that this is enhancing patient autonomy. This is putting pressure on folks to take that option. Once you have the option in law, you create a situation in which it becomes an expectation. Now, Derek Humphrey, who's the Hemlock Society head, the Final Exit book, writes in his more recent book, Freedom to Die, he asks the question this, is there in fact a duty to die? A responsibility within the family unit that should remain voluntary but expected nevertheless. Now just let that sink into your ears. Voluntary but expected nevertheless. Well, how voluntary is it? You don't want to be a burden. No, the safeguards don't work. I think that there is... I think that it is inevitable that you... I think that assisted suicide is the first step in an inevitable process toward voluntary euthanasia. I think it's inevitable for this reason, that if you concede that a person has the right to physician-assisted death, then it actually makes more sense, it's more humane to let the physician do the injection. If you're relying on pills, you can spill the pills, you can vomit them up, it takes a time, it is stressful on all concerned. It's inevitable once you accept physician-accepted suicide. In fact, I think it's a stopgap measure because voluntary euthanasia would not pass the referendum. But it is inevitable. It's an inevitable next step. And it happened in the Netherlands, but it is inherent in creating the problem. It's actually more pro-life to have voluntary euthanasia because you've got to take those pills before you get too sick to take them yourself. Why not wait until I lapse into a coma and then have the doctor inject me? I've expressed my wish. I can't argue against that if you've argued for physician-assisted suicide. So I think it's all the more reason for us to oppose it, and I'll have to say something more about that next time, and not get it confused with the third area, which is non-treatment of when it's right to reject, to refuse medical intervention. I'll thank you for your attention. We'll come back to this topic.